Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Welcome to an hour of Mind Power, and a happy St. Patty's Day to all of you out there on this March 17th. I'm so delighted that I have a real Irishman that's on my show today. His name is Thomas Rice, and we are going to be talking about his wonderful publication, Far From the Land, an Irish memoir. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Don. I appreciate it very much.
Now, you grew up in Carlow, Ireland, and you, on July the 4th of 2009, you celebrated the 50th anniversary of your arrival in the Big Apple, New York City, and you were a scholarship recipient at Cornell University, where you got your doctorate, and you're also a college professor, leadership consultant, and social activist. You have such a fascinating story that you tell about your life and the way things were in Ireland and the times, the history. It was mesmerizing. It really was to go through your book, and I just thought, this had to have taken you a long time to put together. How many years have you dedicated to bringing everything together in the way of information and details? Because you've really taken a journey down a very special memory lane with the book, Far From the Land.
Well, Donna, actually, it only took me a year, a little less than a year, to do the actual writing when I got around to doing it. But it took me all the time between July of 1959 and then, 50 years essentially, to reflect on that and to be in a position where the book pretty much wrote itself, actually, when it came down to it. Because when I got going, after the first few chapters, first few stories, because as you point out, it's surely a series of stories about a way of, in Ireland. And when I got ahead of steam up, they pretty much wrote themselves. I would sit down, and as I told a couple of friends of mine, I wrote during prime time. Everybody else was watching their favorite shows. I was writing, and what would happen at the end of an experience of some kind would remind me of the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
I would just go over to my office, close the door, and 4 or 5, sometimes 8 hours later, I would wake up. And be aware that I'd been sitting in that same place for all that time, and I really hadn't looked up or thought of anything else. So it was a kind of an altered state of consciousness that I wrote in, and that allowed me to be back there and be in that place and very much present with it.
You start out in the very first chapter, which is titled The Man of the House. I went out to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, I drop a berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. I thought it just reminded me of a kid that just is going fishing. It's sort of like an Andy Williams special. And I looked at this and, I looked at all of this and I thought, gee, what a way to start your book off. But what came after the poem was about a cursed stall and a legend that was in your family. Tell us what that was all about.
Well, the poem, of course, is the famous Song of Wandering Angus by William Butler Yeats. And listeners maybe who are tuned in will, of course, know Yeats and his poetry, since he certainly ranks as one of the greatest poets to ever live and certainly one of the great Irish poets. And that poem has always inspired me because you're absolutely right. It covers the big long journey of life, from being that little boy going up to Hazelwood to his final stanza, which I get to later in the book, about the moon and the sun and the stars. That particular episode, though, was our house was one of those places that had a certain gloomy quality to it, and at the same time had a wonderful inspirational quality.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great legends around our house growing up was my grandfather, who had been a somewhat distinguished horseman. He had gone into a stall on a Sunday morning he was breaking a young stallion, and the stallion trapped him against the manger and killed him. They stomped him in the stable, and he left. He was only 32 years old, so he left a family of nine and obviously a very bereft situation. But he also left a stable that was seen to be haunted by his ghost. So no one was ever allowed to go in the stable again, right? And we weren't even allowed to play near it because it was so formidable. And then my mother had the temerity to allow a neighbor of ours to actually to house a young horse that he was breaking, a big Arabian colt, and put him in the stall. And, of course, as kids, we couldn't resist being around the young
mm-hmm,
colt.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular morning, my sisters, who I was much younger than they all were, so they were using me as a kind of experiment and for all sorts of things that they wouldn't do themselves. And one of them was to get on the back of this stallion, of this colt. And so we crawled in there. They threw me up on the horse's back and opened the stable door and gave him a whack. And he took off across the fields with me on his back. And that was when my editor started asking me, what was your earliest childhood memory? You know, my earliest childhood memory was the absolute terror of being on that horse's back and with him flying over hedges. And I was like a kite hanging off his mane in the back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was light as a feather, of course, and I managed to stay on the horse. And that became a bit of a legend in its own right, because we'd broken the spell of the haunted stable, and nothing happened to me. I didn't fall off, and I was actually rescued from the horse's back some time later, and it became kind of a story around home. So that was the earliest childhood memory I had, and I was a little I just turned four at the time.
Well, in Ireland, they're known for their stories. They are known for their pubs and how they'll start talking and you have this weaving of tales and the exaggeration can come in, but the part I especially enjoyed was your mother. Your mother was a real strong woman, and Irish women have always been touted as being tremendously strong human beings. And when your mom was a young girl, she got involved in politics and in battling in her own way for the freedom of her country. Give us a little bit of history about that. Your mom's quite a gal.
She is, actually. I had her story written some years ago, and we never published it for a number of reasons. But she was the oldest of four, and she. It wasn't uncommon for young women at the time. You know, we're talking, she was born in 1908,
mm-hmm.
and Ireland had been under colonial rule for one form or another for about 700 years. And so, in fact, we'd never known freedom. And here we were coming into the 20th century, and we still were under British domination. So, but it came to a head in leading up to World War One, and the entire country became activated around it. So it wasn't uncommon for young people, boys and girls, to get involved in the movement. It was an underground movement. And she joined an organization called the Cumann na mBan, which means women of Ireland. And they were an auxiliary, essentially, to the IRA, which was the freedom movement of the time, the Irish Republican Army. And so their job really was to be a communications network. And so she was arrested for her activities, and she had endless and interesting stories to tell about all that. But she ended up, and this was after a civil war of our own. We formally got our freedom in 1921, and immediately the country was split in two over a treaty that was formed, and the one group went with the original leader, De Valera, and the other followed Michael Collins, who's the first president of Ireland, of the new republic. And she ended up being a loyalist and in prison. She wasn't quite 15 yet. And so they became known, that group became known as the Women of 22, the famous group of young women who actually brought the new government to its knees by virtue of a hunger strike that they went out on, and they were going unconscious after 35 days of being on hunger strike. And she became a kind of a famous personality that I grew up in the shadow of, because it was always, I was Maggie O'Toole's son. I really had no identity of my own whatsoever.
Well, your mother, Maggie, ended up coming to America, but she came to America and ended up meeting your father, who was an alcoholic, and he was quite a bit older than her. It was fascinating to read how she thought she could change this man.
Yes.
And she saw him staggering all over the street. Now, he had a voice, I guess it was just absolutely wonderful. And in her day, when you got married, you stayed married. That was just what you did.
Yes, she did.
And she stayed with him for a long time, but he ended up deserting your family.
Yep.
And it was pretty hard. Now, she ended up going back to Ireland and getting on this farm. Tell us about how that evolved, because in New York, your mother was a good businesswoman.
Right. Well, to begin with, my dad was also an IRA hero, and grew up in Ireland, and he became somewhat famous in the movement as well. And so she fell in love with the mythology and the heroism that surrounded that whole thing. Right, he was 13 years old, and she was only a kid, and she had this big crush on him. So she kind of stalked him, if the truth were only known, because he really didn't even notice her, and she followed him. He got out of the country. He was wanted for all sorts of activities in the movement, and then he followed the wrong movement as well. He was a loyalist, De Valera, who eventually became the heroic president of Ireland, by the way, when it all settled down, and he was kind of president for life of Ireland up through the 1960s, actually. But she followed him and found him in Canada, and she was only an 18-year-old after working her way to England and then the United States. Found him in Canada, convinced him to come down to New York, which he convinced an illegal immigrant into the United States, didn't get his papers, and was discovered because he got drunk in some pub in New York and bragged about beating the Immigration Naturalization Service. So in no time, 24 hours, the INS were around to issue him deportation papers. They didn't serve because they just said, we'll give you 24 hours to get out of the country, but don't come back. Mm-hmm. It was like that. So he was essentially deported. But he inherited the farm in Ireland. So he came home, and they had a three-year-old baby girl at the time, my older sister, who is automatically an American citizen, and she came back to the farm in Ireland, knowing full well that it was a pretty much a doomed scenario, because he was an alcoholic, and he took great pride in his voice, and but that was about it, and he had no intention of taking responsibility for a family. So that was it was all for love, but it was doomed.
Yes, very much so. But your mother, with her strengths and her personality. She had children die because of epidemics, and she thought you were going to die. In fact, she had a little casket that your one baby sister was in, and you were not very old, and she was assuming she was going to have to put you in, but you survived.
Yeah, Don, I'm really impressed. You're one of the few people who's interviewed me who's actually done their homework in this kind of detail. I'm very impressed. Thank you for reading the book so carefully.
Oh, it's a wonderful book. I mean, see, what I think is so amazing about your story is that people today reading about the way life was, that what women went through, and especially in Ireland, because there wasn't a lot of work,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It had been under British dominion. You go into a great deal of detail about the potato famine, which I want you to talk about a little bit, because it's only recently come out in certain historical formatted programs about the fact that the only reason the people of Ireland were starving to death is because their food was taken away from them.
Yes.
But what I wanted to bring out was the fact that at that time, one, sanitation was very bad, although your mother was a neat freak, and she made all of you kids keep everything as clean as possible, which you describe why that wasn't always possible, but the fact that she demanded you get your education. She demanded that all of you, the girls as well as you, get an education and then get out of Ireland as quickly as you can. But talk about the Irish history and the potato famine. And, of course, there was a huge migration to the United States, to anywhere where people had a chance to live.
Well, you know, one thing I try to do in Far From the Land that I consciously tried to do and I set out to do in writing it, I was hoping along the way that somebody else would have written this book. Because I was always looking around for it, and I never found it, so I eventually had to write it myself. And it was to put a different lens on Ireland and Irish, the Ireland that I knew, because I was hoping somebody would actually identify that. But what I always found were these sad sack stories about sort of these broken down, very gloomy scenarios. And that wasn't my experience in growing up at all. It was not about losers, and it wasn't about depressed people. It was actually quite the opposite. I was dealing with just about all the people, and the further away I got from it, the more appreciative I became of this, that I grew up in a very rich cultural context where, mm-hmm. where poetry and music and storytelling and literature was the norm. And all that stuff that we're taught about the shamrock and leprechauns, while it's St. Patrick's Day, I don't do that today, but it's not what Ireland's about. It's about something much richer and much more profound than that. And I wanted to present that, at least that was my truth. And as for the colonial history part, which is glossed over lavishly in all of these accounts, I mean, any nation coming out of a colonial history is one that's going to be struggling for identity.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were trying to do was to find, what was it now, after all, that was unique to our Celtic identity? And how did we rescue our own culture out of that after years of it literally being illegal and having had it repressed for centuries, and still it had been retained and it had been shaped profoundly by hedgerow schoolhouses and by an oral tradition, all of which I grew up in. And while you could formally claim I was illiterate, the fact was I had a very good education.
Mm-hmm.
I had over 100 poems I'd committed to memory. I knew our history. I knew our literature. I knew our myths. I knew our heroes. And it wasn't just me. I mean, that was the way it was, right? And then, you know, in the middle of that, I started, especially after I left Ireland, I started reading these accounts over and over about the famine. As a matter of fact, I read one just last week that was very annoying to me by an Irish-American newspaper here in Boston. And it was the same old lie that gets told all the time about the famine, which is that, you know, that there was the famine by definition is a shortage of food, Donna, right?
Right.
There's an absence of, it's an absolute absence of food. And in our case, there was an abundance of food, and there was an absence of access to it, is what there was. And we were reduced to living on one staple, which was potato. But we grew more beef, we grew more barley, we grew more all of the livestock imaginable, all of it being exported to absentee landlords,
mm-hmm.
Of land that we'd been evicted from. We were living on our own farms, farming them and doing a very good job, and very productive farming, and we were reduced to eating the most meager part of it all. And when that failed, of course, we starved. But the terror that had been instilled in the population was so great that nobody dare touch one ounce of that food because the consequences would be so dire for everybody. So whole families starved to death against little lean-tos on their own farms with an abundance of food right there.
Mm-hmm. The details that you give, I think, are just excellent. And what I like is the fact that this is your story. You're talking about the real people. You're talking about the making of a young man, the initiation into manhood that you had to go through. You talk about how part of your coming into your own manhood was greatly supported by Davy, who was a horse whisperer. Now, that term really became popular when Robert Newman
right.
played in the movie The Horse Whisperer here. But horse whisperers in various cultures, and the Irish have always been known about being good with the horses. But he really had a very special gift. And you and this man had a tremendous bond. And he was in love with one of your sisters, and it didn't work out because your mother wouldn't let it happen. He was a farmer, and she just didn't think that was something. I really felt a sadness for Davy, because this was a very talented man that was in a very hard situation that did outstandingly well and yet never married, and you left Ireland and he gave up the farm when you left because you were the person, I guess, he thought he was going to be able to turn his farm over to.
That's right, Donna. You know, I just got extraordinarily lucky because right next door to us was this person that was seen as, he was very iconoclastic guy. He very seldom talked to anybody except his horses, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's very difficult for people who didn't grow up around anything rural to appreciate this. But the way it worked around farm country is any animal you had was seen as highly functional, right? You didn't have things just for pets or for show.
Right.
And they really had to earn their living. And so horses particularly would be heavy draft animals, right, who would be able to pull a plow and be able to hold their own, be very robust. And here was this guy who had a very difficult farm, very heavy farm to work. He had these Arabians that were actually show horses. They're these beautiful, for those who don't know horses, they come in various colors, but dominantly white. But they're high stepping, they're spirited, they prance and dance around, they take off at the slightest twitch, and so it's the last thing you would want around a farm. They're downright dangerous because they bolt and they're very difficult to train. And here he was he was working these horses and plowing with them of all things, which nobody ever did. You'd plow with draft horse with Clydesdales
mm-hmm.
or Belgians or these kinds of heavy legged strong animals. So one morning, I'm about 6 years old. I step out. I was vaguely aware of Davy, but not much because I would see him in the distance and he didn't mix with the neighbors in normal course of events. And here he was doing what I learned that he did as a matter of mission, which was helping a neighbor who seemed to be in trouble, which was us. He was plowing one of our fields that needed plowing. He was, this was about 6 o'clock in the morning, already had a whole bunch of work done, a beautiful, beautiful May morning. And so I just noticed, the very first thing I noticed about him was that he was talking to these horses as though they were human beings.
And he
had no reins on them. He had reins, but he wasn't using the reins. He was just having a conversation with the horses. And where other farmers would be pulling on the reins and dragging on it and whipping the horses a little bit, he was doing none of that. He was just having a conversation. And then he got to the end of the row, as I write about. And my very first experience of being terrified was he said he had a modest disapproval. He had an intake of breath because one of the mares wasn't doing exactly what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And she just reared up and let forth a loud, whee that the horses do when they're upset. And I ran away. I was just, I wet my pants. I was so scared. And he called me back. He noticed and called me back. He said, no, you don't need to be scared. She's just she's a little upset. It's all right. And then he noticed. He said, you seem to like the horses. Why don't you come down tomorrow and I'll let you work with me. And from that day forth, for the next 10 years, I was around him just about every day in some form or another, and he taught me how to work those horses, and he taught me some of the things. I mean, I could never be. He was truly gifted. He had an amazing talent with horses, but he taught me the basics, and he allowed me to work with those horses. By the time I was 14, I was getting pretty good with Arabians.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an amazing experience that I had with him.
Well, you have so much in your book. One of the portions that is just amazing, again, is about the history. But there came a time, it was during the month of December, and you were out in the barn, and you were just, it was 1958, December 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you say, that it's stamped in your memory indelibly, because it was on that particular day that a gentleman came by. I believe his name is Andy.
Right, you're right.
And Andy said something to you that made you aware that you must leave Ireland. And the words were just amazing. He said, Sonny, I've lived on this mountain over 60 years before you were born. I've seen great men and women die before their time. I've seen people driven off by bailiffs and banks. And he goes on and on. But he says, I care about you, and I'll give it to you anyhow. If I were young again, I'd get the hell out of here and make something of myself. You're a bright lad, could almost tell one's fortune, and I know you'd be a great man at whatever you turn your hand to. This is no place for a man to spend his life. And there's more to it. I just took a few sentences out of what you've written. But those are powerful words, and that turned your life around. And you ended up talking your mother into leaving the farm with you. And then you have adventures with that. You go to England, and to read about the way it was in England, just incredible. But what I thought was something was your mother, when she agreed to falsify your father's signature so you could have a right to get the visa and get out of England to come to America. Your mother, who was a person that never, ever tolerated a lie or anything else, when you said to her, Mom, you've got to do it because your father just wouldn't sign the papers.
Right.
And he was drunk, and he wouldn't do it.
Right.
But she said, yep, I'll do it. And she forged his signature, and you guys came to America.
True. Now, all that part is absolutely right. You know, the leaving, one of the things, Donna, that I do spend a couple of chapters on in, because the cadence of the book, as you quite rightly point out, I mean, it moves from, there's a section one there called Foundation Stones, and it really is about the way of life of a people that
mm-hmm.
is rapidly fading away, by the way. You can still find that in Ireland if you go to Ireland today. You just have to get off the beaten path. You know, you're not going to find it in the Bord Fáilte, the tourist brochures. But you can find that Ireland still, and you can find those storytellers, you can find all that. But what I underestimated completely was the pain you don't think much about the consequences when you're 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm constantly trying to get my children to anticipate consequences. But I also remember when I was 16, I didn't anticipate anything like this. And I thought of myself as mature. But I had no idea how difficult it was going to be to extricate when I actually had that moment of truth with Andy in the rain on that December 15th. And of course, the other piece that I make much of is the importance of weather in terms of the way it affects your mood.
Mm-hmm.
And the day is, you know, the day is so short in the Northwest Atlantic. That you're down to 3:30 in the afternoon, right, before, you know, and it's dark.
Right.
So that gets downright depressing. And if you're looking at months of that, and I was training young horse, and I was generally failing at it, and it was one of those, I'm looking at another long winter. So it was one of the fairly classic thing as a 16-year-old would do. But those words, when someone says to you, "This is no way for a man to spend his life," it forever reminded me of how impressionable young people are and how powerful words can be in a given moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably why I became a teacher, because I think you can have enormous influence, hopefully for the good, if you are passionate about it. But then extricating and leaving people and leaving everything I loved. All the critiques I had suddenly went away at that moment of decision. You know, I had the space them out to realize how much I loved the place and everything in it. So now I'd made the decision, but implementing it was all of the story, and it was the most painful thing I've ever done in my life. No question about it. But at the same time, I had been raised to, you know, to see things through, and seeing it through was the main thing. And in order to get to the United States, we had to go earn some money in Sheffield, because there was no other way to do it. But that was one of the great learning experiences of my life, and I wouldn't exchange that. People still ask me, you know, do you think it was a mistake to go to Sheffield, and given all that happened there and the prejudice and discrimination against the Irish? And my answer is always the same, as no, I absolutely think it was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Going to England, because I never would have had it's not likely, when you come to the United States as an Irish person, you don't suffer any discrimination. Other people have discrimination here, but not the Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And but in England, you know, we were the untouchables is the word I was reaching for. We weren't just the low on the totem pole. We were absolutely untouchable. We had no name. We had no identity. We were a despised minority. We were everything that was seen as despicable, and we were also seen as terrorists. Don't forget. Like, that's why I have great empathy with people from the Middle East here today who are just because they look a particular way, they're automatically assumed to be terrorists. And I had that experience in England. Very much you spoke the first word that came out and sounded Irish, you automatically assumed that you're going to do something terrible to somebody. I never would have had that kind of empathy or compassion had I not had that Sheffield experience. So in that sense, Donna, it was very much a character-forming experience, and I wouldn't have missed it.
Thomas J. Rice is my guest. Thomas, do you have a website? We're out of time. Do you have a website that we can go to if we want to find out more about Far From the Land and your other writings?
I do, and I have it's thomasjrice.com, and you can buy the book on there. And by the way, Don, I also like people to know I'm donating the next 6 months of proceeds from the book to Haitian Relief. Particularly Paul Farmer's Partners in Health, because I want to keep the Haitian issue on the front burner and help out a little bit.
Oh, well, that is wonderful.
So it's a double good. You get a good read on Ireland. You'll do something of great use for Haiti, and hopefully be able to pass the book around to some of your friends and educate them a bit and enjoy some Irish literature.
Thomas J. Rice has been my guest. Go to his website, Thomas J. Rice. The book is mesmerizing. It's the real thing. It's his memoir. And you will find that you will be just as captivated as I was by reading it. Far From the Land, an Irish memoir, appropriately here on St. Paddy's Day. Thomas Rice, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been a delight having you. We're taking a break, and we will be back in just a moment.
Thank you, Donna.
You're welcome.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sivo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast, with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hello and welcome back. This is Donna. I'll tell you, the book, Far From the Land, you get into it, you're in a whole different time zone, and you need to make sure that you can cozy up with the book and just read it. I wanted to share something that he had in his book. He has a number of quotes and poetry, but when you think about the way people had to live at that time, it's just amazing. But he has a quote in here by Albert Einstein. And again, this is Thomas J. Rice. Your decision to be, have, and do something out of the ordinary entails facing difficulties that are out of the ordinary as well. Let me repeat that. Your decision to be, have, and do something out of the ordinary entails facing difficulties that are out of the ordinary as well. You don't get anywhere in this life without stumbling, falling, going through agitation, tears, experiences that sometimes will just tear your very soul. Why? That's often the question. We'll ask, why me? Believe it or not, it's been my observation that the character of a person is created by how they deal with their experiences. And when you read Far From the Land, you watch the life of a woman who is absolutely amazing, a time in history that is often so misrepresented. And more than that, you find out about what it takes to dare to be different, which is what Thomas Rice did. It's an amazing story. It really, really is. And that's something I find with many of the people that are guests on this show. Many of them have walked paths and experiences that when we hear about them, we go, wow, would I have been able to survive it? What would have I done if I had been in their positioning? We don't know. But the glorious thing about reading and about books is they're like friends, and you can take them with you wherever you go. Oh, I know they've got the Kindles out there, and they've got all of these different things. But to me, maybe it's just because of the way I was raised, and my passion for books has always been there. I don't know where it came from in the family. I seem to be the odd duck that had a passion for it, because there's nobody else I know of in my family that actually loves learning the way I do and just loves to read and likes to know about all kinds of things. But when you have that book, remember, that book is something that has value. Whenever somebody really writes something good, I'm not talking about trash. I get trash too. Not a heck of a lot, but I do get some. And it just amazes me that people will spend time on publishing things that are just absolutely of no substance. But that's life, and everybody has a right to choose what they're going to read. However, when you have something that's really special, have a pen in hand and write in the book. You know, I've gone to secondhand bookstores, and I've picked up books, and you might think, oh, that's terrible to write in a book. It isn't. You know, sometimes the books I've picked up and that are in my library today were owned by someone else, and they made notations too, and it gave me a peek inside of their mind and how they thought and why something was so important to them that they read. And it caused me to pause and reread maybe what they had italicized, making a connection, association. Books really are friends. And they can take you anywhere in the world into different time zones, project you forward, take you back. Sometimes just be right where you are, right at the moment. But it allows you to expand your paradigms and to gain insights into people, situations, and conditions that maybe you will not have to go through. And that can be a very positive thing in some instances. But education is an ongoing process, and you never, ever get there. If ever you find someone saying, oh, you don't need to learn any more about this, you don't need to learn any more about that, this is all that's been done, just perk up your ears, look at them, and go, mm-hmm, I'm moving on out of this situation. Because nobody ever gets there. We're always going to be in a learning curve somewhere. And you know what? That's downright exciting. This is Donna Sebo. If you want to give me a buzz, 888-815-9756 is the telephone number to call in to. And on this St. Patrick's Day, I hope you just have a great time wherever you're going to be. But I'd like to let you know who we're going to be having on tomorrow and Friday. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with a lady who is in her 80s. Her name is Sylvia. Sylvia has published a book called Sylvia's Haven. This is a story of her life, and it is a story about something she founded years ago where she's been able to help over 1,300 abused women and children. It has been a dedication of her life, and she's feisty as she can be, and she's going to be my guest tomorrow. And then, hey, summertime is coming up, and maybe you want to plan on visiting some areas. Well, how would you like to know about places to see? We're going to be talking about arts in America with Jeffrey Compton on Friday. This is a wonderful publication because you can just open it up and just check out all kinds of places throughout the United States, and we're going to be talking about a few of them, where you can experience some phenomenal art, wonderful activities, and it's something that you can plan on. It's right there for you to turn to, maybe even in your own local environment, where if you were on a tight budget and maybe you didn't have a whole bunch of money to spend, Well, we've got some ideas and some suggestions for you. So that's coming up on Friday. Well, I think we're going to be taking a break here in just a moment. And I thought, you know what, I need to share a recipe with you today. So why don't I do that? And how about, well, what do you think? An Irish recipe? You got it. When we come back, I'll have something for you, something special. And it might be end up being two if I have the time. Anyway, if you want to chat with me, 888-815-9756. Oops, I almost forgot. Before we go on break, I'm going to be attending what used to be the Boeing Expo. The name has been changed. It's the Emerald Spiral Spring Expo. It's on Saturday, March 27th. It's going to be from 9 in the morning until 5 in the late afternoon at Kent Commons in Kent, Washington. This is a fabulous event. It is just so wonderful to be able to go into this event and have a chance to talk to just about everybody. It's a rather small event. There's only, maybe about 75 to 100 vendors there, but it is a wonderful group of people. Fabulous jewelers. You've got readers of all kinds. You've got people with different talents and abilities in the psychic area. I'm going to be there. I'll have a booth, and I'll be doing mini consultations. Plus, I'll have a slew of books. So come on over to the Emerald Spiral Spring Expo if you're in the Western Washington area. Saturday, March 27th, starting at 9 a.m., going on until 5. Look forward to seeing you there. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right, Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272. Tacoma, Washington 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Quickly, before we go to a caller that's waiting, and I want to thank you, caller, for being so patient, I want to let you know, if you have a story about the paranormal, if you've experienced a ghost, if you have legends in your family, I'd love to hear about it. The reason being, I'm putting together a book. I'm wanting 100 stories, and yours could be one that's included. Do send me an email, donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. Be sure to put in the subject line, story for book, or the Donna Sebo Show, or something like that where I can identify it. And then have your contact information also included, because you may have an opportunity to be in the book. And, of course, we'll need that information from you. So we've set the objective of a year to collect the 100 stories, and they're moving right along. I'm really pleased with how people are responding. So if you have that special story, do send it along. Also, if you want to get my email newsletter, just send me an email as well and say, add me to the list, Donna, and we'll be putting you on that too. Let's go to our caller who's been waiting very patiently. Thank you so very much. First name or initial. Where are you calling from?
Al, from Michigan.
From Michigan. Where in Michigan?
Farmington Hills.
Ah, okay. I think you've called in before. By the way, I had a chance to be on with one of your talk show hosts. His name is Jeremy, and I'm trying to remember right off the top of my head. I don't have, well, maybe I'll have it here. I don't have his name in front of me, but I may have the opportunity to be on a mission in Michigan. It's Lansing, Michigan. It's W-L-I-S. Jack, not Jeremy, it's Jack Ebling. I may have a chance to be on his show again. So I'll be listened to by those of you in Michigan. So that's a wonderful opportunity. So you may hear about that. Excuse me, hon?
I said, absolutely. That's beautiful. That's wonderful.
All right. Now, let's get down to you, Elle. First thing that I'm looking at is an upset stomach, which is interesting to me. And I think it's just stress. I think that you're internalizing a lot of anxiousness. And when I look at this, I want to say, deal with the facts. If you have to go out and dig in the ground for a little bit, if you can in Michigan at this time, or if you want to walk around a block or jump rope or whatever it is that you have to do, you've got to find some way of alleviating this internal stress patterning because the body is taking a beating. And sometimes a good way to do it is writing. But I think with you doing something physical, washing windows, cleaning a floor, you remind me of a friend of mine. That's what she would do. But I think whatever it is that you can do physically that can shift your mind and your emotions so that you can balance yourself out, the better it's going to be for you. There is a real need for you to be able to deal with facts, Elle, and not let your emotions take you on a roller coaster ride. This is not going to be fun, and the health, your health, is going to be paying a price that you just don't want. It's not necessary. And so we learn these habits, and sometimes it's pretty tough to break them. So if you can, detach emotionally. Don't allow things to get you into such a distressed level. It just isn't worth it. What would you like to ask me today?
I'm hoping to be able to see a friend of mine in the next few days, and I wondered if you thought I'd be able to do that.
Well, barring bad weather, I don't see why you wouldn't be able to do that. Why are you anxious about this?
Because they haven't been well, and I feel bad about that, and I'm wanting to go visit them.
Well, what I want you to do is just relax about this. That they have not been feeling up to par, all right, that's fine. But worrying about it there just isn't going to make a difference. What you want to do is put yourself in a state of mind where you just say, you know what, if this is going to work out, this is going to work out. If it's not going to work out, it's not going to work out. I am just going to let things be and lighten up about this because there's too much that's going on inside of you that it's bothering me because I'm seeing all of this stress that you shouldn't have. You don't need it.
Okay. All right.
But just relax and enjoy it. The only thing, barring weather, and nobody can control the weather, at least I don't know of anybody who can, I think you're going to have a good time.
Okay, so you think I will get to go see him over this coming next couple of days?
Yes, just what I said, unless the weather is bad.
Got it.
Unless something is bad. But there's no need to stress over this. Because if you do, you're going to be just so stressed out, you're not going to enjoy it even if you do go.
Okay, got it.
All right?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Count your blessings, honey. You've got a lot. This is Donna Sebo, and I've got a recipe for you, corned beef with cabbage and apple. Now, I know it's already St. Patrick's Day. You probably would have wanted to have had this recipe in advance, but time didn't allow me to do this yesterday. So here is this recipe for corned beef brisket that I think you will absolutely love. Now, you're going to need 4 pounds of corned beef, and, of course, every grocery store has that. You're going to need 1 head of green cabbage, about 1.5 pounds, and you want to core it, and you want to chop it into chunks. You want it chunky. And then you need 2 Gala apples. You want to core those and cut them into half-inch slices. And then you need 2 ribs of celery, and you cut those up into 1-inch pieces. You're going to need about 3 tablespoons of oil, 2 tablespoons of prepared horseradish. I like the hotter the better, but you may not want it that spicy. And then how about a half a teaspoon of salt, a quarter of a teaspoon of pepper? You're going to need 3 tablespoons of spicy brown mustard, 2 tablespoons of dark corn syrup. Now, if you don't like corn syrup, try maple, the real stuff, not the fake stuff. So you'll need about 2 tablespoons of that, a quarter of a teaspoon of garlic powder, and then you might want to have some fresh parsley for a garnish. But let me tell you how you do. Now, you can place your beef in a large pot, and you add enough water to cover it by 2 inches. You want to put it over high heat and bring it to a boil. Once it's boiling, you cover it, reduce the heat to medium, and you simmer it until it's very, very tender. Now, that's going to take about 3 hours. So it's one of these, put it in the pot, forget it. This is where a crock pot can just be absolutely super. Then you drain. After it's cooked, just fork tender, then you're going to drain it. And about 45 minutes before your meat is done, you want to put a rack in the center of your oven and preheat it to 375 degrees. Get out your roasting pan. It needs to be a sizable one. You want to take your cabbage, apples, and celery. You want to toss it with your oil, your horseradish, salt, and pepper until it's all coated real, real well. Now, I would encourage you to spray with a nonstick cooking spray the inside of the pan, and then after that, you cover everything, put all the goodies inside of it, roast it until it's softened at 375 for about 30 minutes, and then another little bowl, combine your mustard, corn syrup, or maple syrup, and garlic powder, put to the side, place your beef on top of the cabbage mixture, spread the reserve mustard mixture over the beef, roast it uncovered until the glaze bubbles and the cabbage is tender, about 10 minutes. Yum! We're out of time. My goodness, how does it go so fast? Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Enjoy your shamrocks and your green beer. Have a good time, because we're going to be right here at BBS, same time, same place, tomorrow. This is Donna Sebo. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.